I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Nina and Rocky, a lifestyle brand bringing you hospitality and wellness from the very heart of Gaya. I don't know about you, but when life gets busy for me, it's great to know that there's a service out there to make it all easier. Nina and Rocky offers hospitality and wellness on your terms because you deserve to receive more than you expect from a service. From vacation time to everyday life, Nina and Rocky is here to make your life better by providing a wide range of experiences and customized services. Nina and Rocky is your go-to for all of your daily living needs. Find out more by going to @NinaRockyLife on Instagram or go to ButlerExperienceMallorca.com. Hello and welcome to Daya Unpacked. In this episode, I speak to a brilliant man with a long history with Daya and Mallorca. A musician, a businessman, a scientist, an expert on water, and just an overall super guy, Stephen Lambert. In our talk, we learn about Stephen's early days in Daya, playing chess with the tough guys, and playing guitar with Kevin Ayers. Stephen shares some fascinating stories and knowledge in this extraordinary talk. Stay tuned to the very end to hear Stephen play a stunning acoustic version of Lady Rachel, a song by Kevin Ayers. Hi, everybody. We are sitting in my living room this afternoon. It's like the quintessential summer day. It's really warm. The crickets are chirping, and all you want to do is go down to the beach. And I have a really interesting man sitting with me here. His name is Stephen Lambert. And yeah. I am going to say that he is a Daya original. Oh. You're definitely an original.
I wasn't born here, but yeah.
You have a long, vast history.
I washed up here. Yeah.
You washed up here. So yeah, tell me the washed up story. How did you make it here to Daya?
It was 1979. And I'd been through university as a young guy and failed miserably because we had a band that went out on the road and we did 1,000 gigs rather than 1,000 hours studying. And then I had nothing to do, so I took off to join somebody who had passed their degree who was teaching in the Sudan. And so we flew to Khartoum. And this is the beginning of a story of 1979. In, I think, April, we flew to Khartoum, and I went 3 months through the Sudan, down the Blue Nile, and across to the Red Sea, and travelled with the Bedouins, did everything you really could do in 3 months, nearly got toasted in the desert, nearly got buried in the desert, you know, had a few interesting experiences as the only white person that some people had seen since General Gordon had been there.
So were you totally alone?
Three of us went, and then we went our separate directions to see if we could make it back to the same place at the same time. One went west, one went east, and one went north.
So what compelled you? What compelled this
trip? I always wanted to do Africa. I always wanted to see Africa until I got there and realized that Africa is enormous and Sudan is big enough to be the food bowl of the whole of the world. And the history, and I was fascinated in fresh water. I'd studied fishery science, although I didn't pass.
So I want to just very quickly, before you go on, just ask you about that. So you were in uni, you were in university in England.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were also a musician.
Well, I played guitar since I was about 12.
So you had a band while you were in uni?
I didn't have any money. We didn't qualify for a grant in those days. I think my dad earned just too much, but not enough.
Right, right.
And so we started a band. Jack Shepherd, myself, and we started a folk club at the university, and we started inviting people like John Martin and Bridget St. John and some very interesting people in my genre of music, things that I'd studied, folk and blues, since I was 12. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we met their agents,
mm-hmm.
and we had our own band called Steeplejack. And then the agents sent us off on a tour. This is where my degree went left.
Got it. So you were putting all of your time and energy into the music and didn't have the time and energy.
And I was on the wrong degree. On the wrong degree as well.
What degree was that? Fishery science. Okay.
I was interested. I grew up on a lake in Hertfordshire, and I always wanted to know what was under the lily leaf.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it? Was a medieval lake. Yeah, in the middle of nowhere.
Wow.
So I was fascinated by fishing and playing music, and you know, that was my life.
Mm-hmm.
So having done the Sudan and mm-hmm. arrived back in England
mm-hmm.
in, I think it was June,
mm-hmm.
I lodged in a flat in Highgate, yeah, mm-hmm. Which was 20 miles from where my parents lived.
Okay, so I interrupted your Sudan adventure. So you were not doing well in university, and you just decided randomly to go to Africa.
Somebody who passed their degree in English got a job teaching English in Khartoum, just south of Khartoum. So as young people, we followed each other. And the rumour was that if one got to Africa, one could get a job. And I thought, well, I'll get a job working on the river or doing something useful. But when I got there, you had to have the degree to get the job.
Got it.
To get the papers, etc. And I didn't have the degree. So I went walkabout instead, which was fascinating.
Which is as good as a degree.
Yeah, the Red Sea coast, a village called Suakin, built of coral, just south of Port Sudan.
Wow.
Travelling with Bedouins, amazing. Where you learn that... That was fascinating.
I'm sure.
6 days with a Bedouin camel train.
Wow.
That was amazing.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, I have not spent any time on the African continent yet.
Well, the one thing you would...
It's changed a lot since...
It was safe when I was there.
Yeah.
It was safe.
Yeah.
It's not safe
now. A lot of political turmoil right now.
Yeah, yeah, the places we went to, one couldn't go to now. We went all the way down the Blue Nile as well. To the Ethiopian border and across to Niala, which is now Darfur, which is the terror zone.
I know.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And it was paradise.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. Did you see any indication that would lead to...
No.
No. So it was just a great place.
No, when the president came down the road, they shut it for 5 days before he arrived. Here we have mañana, yeah?
Yeah.
There they have bukra, which is tomorrow.
Yeah.
But in the Sudan, it's baida bukra, which is the day after tomorrow.
So it's really slow living.
It was very slow living and stayed in mud huts and saw the Abyssinian Plateau, saw the 1,000 square miles of pink flamingos.
What an experience.
Yeah.
What an adventure. Would you advise that to any young adult?
Today?
To take an adventure like that? I feel like it's not done.
The world is not as safe today. Maybe South America, places in South America. We recently went to Patagonia and all the way around Patagonia. That's worth doing. That's safe.
Mm-hmm.
But would I... God knows what my mother was thinking. Left at home... Me at 24, disappeared off into the middle of Africa.
No smartphone.
No smartphone.
No communication.
Nothing. Nothing. My father found me. There was a cartoon club which was very English. And there was a post box there. So one could give the cartoon club as a post box. And so after 2.5 months of travelling, I made it back to Khartoum. Went to my post box, or the post box, and there was my tax return that my dad...
Your dad sent you your tax return. That is
hilarious.
Dear
Steve, I hope everything's going well. Here's your tax return.
And was that the impetus to then go back to England?
No, I came back to England because we only had 3 months, I think, at the time. There was some reason, and I also ran out of money.
Oh.
So...
The return didn't last very long. The tax return didn't
last. It was a bill from the tax people. So I had to go back and sort it and had to come back. So I came back to London and we had rented a room in a shared flat in Highgate in North London.
With friends?
With friends.
The same guys you travelled with?
Different group. And one of them was a friend of mine from School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, David Platt. Mm-hmm. And he had a friend at SOAS called Eric Flacol or Daniel Alegria.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, I think at the time, a third Dan in Wadaru Karate. And I'd given up my martial arts when I went travelling and failed university. So I started studying Wadaru with Eric.
So are you a martial artist as well?
Yes, but not at high level.
Okay.
But many, many years.
Wow. Yeah. What belt?
I only ever got to a brown belt.
Which is pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
Highly skilled. Are you still practicing?
No. Because I gave up karate and then took up Aikido.
Super cool.
And because Aikido is more the art of avoidance. It's all about where I've been and who I've met and who one can train with.
Yeah.
I'm a great believer in training with people who are at a very high level.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Yes. That's my philosophy as
like,
well.
I found it very difficult studying with a fresh black belt because they may have passed all their junior exams, but have they really got the philosophy of the subject?
I think when it comes to things like martial arts, you always want to look for the sagest and most experienced person in the room, and that's who you want to go
with. Eric was being taught by Tatsu Suzuki, who was the world master. Yeah?
Well.
So, anyway, Eric and I trained together,
and
he introduced me to Suzuki, and I used to go to School of Oriental and African Studies once a week or twice a weekend. And train. This is my memory, okay? Eric would probably say you only turned up once every 3 weeks. But
well, he'll have to come on the podcast.
Yeah, he'll have to come on. He's coming. He's coming next week.
Oh, that's fun.
So, anyway, we were drinking in the Holloway Road one evening, as you do.
Yeah.
And he said he was going to Mallorca for the summer. What was I doing? So I said, well, nothing. I'm hanging loose and pumping petrol to earn a living. You know, I was working on a petrol pump. And so I'd been recording some music in, playing guitar for some joint friends in a studio. And that came to an end. We were auditioning people. And I was just doing the twiddly bits for people auditioning for a London show. That came to an end. So I just said, yes. Why not? Let's go to Mallorca.
And you'd never been.
And I'd never been.
And what was your impression of what it was before you went?
I had no idea.
You didn't know.
No, I had no idea. Yeah. Didn't know where it was.
That was my experience too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just a jewel and island, and people talked about it, and I'd heard of. You know, the Costa del Sol in Spain, and had no idea what I was coming to. But Eric was born here.
Okay.
And he grew up in...
But he's not Mallorcan, though. He's an Englishman?
No, he's half Nicaraguan.
Okay.
Half American. And his parents had a house in the Clot. Camblao.
Who were his parents?
Claribel Alegría. And Bud Flacol.
Okay.
Right. Claribel was a poet, a Nicaraguan poet, and Bud was a diplomat.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And so they, I think, had met in
Malibu. I wonder what years they came here. What years had his family come here?
I think it was the late, early 60s or... Well, okay. Eric had grown up
so they kind of knew the whole crew here.
They knew everybody.
Period. Okay, so they must have known Huguette and Renee, which...
Yeah, they knew everybody.
Okay.
I mean, Claribel eventually got the King's Award for her work of poetry just before she died a few years ago.
The King's Award of England?
No, in Spain.
In Spain.
Yeah.
Oh.
And
super interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And so Eric brought me here. And I remember him saying, yeah, come on holiday, man, but I don't want to be tied at the hip. Okay.
Smart.
I had no idea.
What does that mean?
Just don't follow me around.
Right. Yeah. Right. I give you a bed.
Yeah, I give you a bed.
I don't want to see you.
Give me a bed. I don't want to see you.
I think I've got my own life. I think it's a good philosophy.
Yeah, yeah. So Eric and I arrived, and I think I got paged for something. I got a rental car, and we used to call it a rent and dent, because in those days, you just...
Yeah.
The airport was tiny. Everything was unsophisticated. And I remember driving to Daya and arriving in this beautiful mountain village and going straight to the Kala in the rent and dent. There was no park. There was no parking. There were no lines. There was no. There was nothing. One could just drive straight to the Kala from the airport, get out and swim. So we did that, and then we went to the bar. Then,
What an amazing first experience in Daya, though. Like, just to go from. Wait, what was it even like for you when you drove from the airport into Daya? How was that for you?
It was interesting. There weren't the motorways. It was unsophisticated,
yeah, it was
undeveloped.
Super small.
It was 1979.
Yeah.
And Daya was small.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. It had a wonderful vibe about it.
Yeah.
The Kala blew me away completely.
I'm sure it did. Were the restaurants still there at that
time? Yeah, the restaurants were there. The two restaurants were there. There were some nice cafes and bars in the centre of town. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was obviously a level of sophistication, because above town were some smarter restaurants. I can't remember the names. But Eric will. Eric, okay. When you interview Eric, if you get...
Eric, I'm coming for you.
Yeah, okay. And Thomas will tell you. So anyway, I spent the first night on Claribel and Bud's sofa downstairs. And then Bud got up in the morning and said, "It's been great knowing you." Being the diplomat. So I got my backpack... And Eric and I went up to the cafe to think about things. Where was I going to stay?
Right.
What was I going to do? And we bumped into one of his school friends, who was Thomas Graves.
Super cool.
I knew nothing about any of these people. I came from a normal background. Mum worked in a bank and my dad was an engineer.
I love that you use the word normal. That's very funny.
Well,
yes, I understand.
Yeah, and I'd been, you know, to ordinary schools.
So you're kind of like in a little bit of an Alice in Wonderland experience, right?
It was a bit strange, yes, it was a bit strange. But anyway, I met Thomas, and we met Thomas, and Eric and Thomas had a conversation in a language that I didn't understand at all, which was their Catalan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we walked up the road and towards the church, and I was given an apartment for 10 days. And as Thomas says now, once you put a hippie up for a night, you can never get rid of them.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah, so this is 50 years later or something like that.
You're still around, Steve.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was my introduction to Daya. And then the next day, I remember Eric saying, "We'll meet in the cafe." And there were two sisters who ran the bar that's now closed, the pizza house.
We're Es Puntas?
Yeah, I think so. And so we all met there for croissant and coffee in the morning and decided what to do.
I remember when it was that.
Yeah. Do you remember?
I do. I think it was that. Yeah, I remember it was like a little cafe. But I came 10 years later. I came in 89.
Okay. Yeah, it was still there.
Yeah, it was still there. I loved it.
Yeah.
You can go and get like a bocata or cheese and a pavoli.
Yeah, and there was
coffee.
A whole community there.
There was a whole community there.
There was
very cool.
There was Una's dad. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There was George Sheridan, Cecily's husband. And they were all, I found most of the people were either 10 years younger than me or 10 years older than me.
Right.
Yeah.
But Tomas was your age.
Tomas is 2 or 3 years older than me, and Eric was 1 year older than me.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're kind of a peer group there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But, and they all knew each other.
Yeah.
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 And they had a band, and this went on for about a week, and I met people, and I also played chess. In that restaurant, in that bar, there was a chess club, which you may
have heard about. It.
Heard about.
There's a tremendous reputation with that.
Yeah.
Chess club.
So we used to play chess.
Would you say that's where all the guys went to kind of beat their chest and?
They got really upset if they lost. They got really upset. One guy. I'm not going to name him, but I only played him once, and he lost, and he never played me again. George was great, Cecily's husband. Uh-huh. George would play you and beat you, you know, like 5-2. You
know, but he can handle the losses.
He can handle the loss, and he could have. But some of them couldn't. And
that's an interesting. That's so fascinating to me. The people who can't handle the losses.
Yeah,
that's an extreme level of competitiveness.
And I was just there because I love playing chess.
Which is a great game.
And when I was at school, we had a history teacher who one leg shorter than the other, and he, Mr. Henley, and he used to play 15 games of chess at once. So he'd pair up all the boys in the class and walk around and play 15 games.
It's fantastic.
And he was a master, super chess
cool.
master.
Yeah, it's
so
great.
Super cool.
Super
boom,
cool.
Boom, 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 boom. So
I
anyway,
think we should bring chess back to the village. I'd love chess to come back to the village.
That'd be really good.
What I think is very interesting about the whole chess thing and the history of chess in the village, and I've talked about this with other people on the podcast, when you came to Data, and even when I came to Data, though it was lesser, there was an incredible male energy here. There's extreme male energy.
Found that.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think it's unquestionable. And I think the whole chess thing and certain things that were happening in the village were a testament to this real, this kind of a machismo and a masculine energy that was very much of that time period. I think very much, you know, that post-World War II.
Yeah.
Moving into
lots kind of people came from America.
Lots of people came from America. It was a little bit of also a place where men were unrestricted in their ability to just be like guys.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist anymore.
No. Well, it wouldn't.
It wouldn't pass now.
It wouldn't be awake, could it?
It wouldn't fly now. It wouldn't fly now. But it made for such an interesting time. It created such a wild and fascinating ambiance in this place.
It did.
Yeah.
And some people would say it was a good thing. And other people might say it wasn't such a good thing.
Yeah.
But it
I think it's both.
It's both, and it I'm choosing my words very carefully here because, as
of course,
being 10 years younger than most of the macho guys and being English and not American and not speaking Spanish and not having a, let's say, a privileged background, it was quite intimidating.
Absolutely.
Because they would actually put you out of a group.
Of course.
Yeah, or invite you into a group.
That's right.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you had to know your place. And if you stepped out of place, one could be sidelined.
Yeah.
Yeah? And it's quite interesting because...
Fascinating.
I was younger. I was 24.
And you're also kind of a low-key individual, if I can say so. Like,
yeah.
You're kind of chill. You're chill, low-key.
Well, I wasn't so much then.
Maybe you were.
most of their partners were 10 years younger. So
right.
Most of their partners were my age.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were the guy they confided in. They were like, Steve, my God. This
yeah. You got it in one.
That's excellent. Well, yeah, it makes complete
you
sense.
You got it in one.
Could you imagine the kind of energy it took to harness those males?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I mean, I always think about the woman. I always think about the woman because I think the woman had to harness and keep some sanity in the whole equation. They were also raising children. They were, they were feeding kids.
Yeah.
Then there's the whole story of the kids.
Yeah.
Right?
Who are now in their 30s and I'm watching them grow up and run the bar and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
It's very interesting. It was an interesting time. For my first time here,
mm-hmm.
and I think...
When did you know that you fit in?
I moved from Tomasi's house
mm-hmm.
Into... There was an artist in the town called Paul Hogarth.
Mm-hmm. I've heard the name.
Yeah, and his wife and he had separated, I think, and he had a house at the bottom of the Clot, on the bend at the bottom, on this side of the bend. Yeah, on the inside of the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the time at Tomasi's apartment came to an end, I went to stay down at the bottom of the Clot in Paul Hogarth's wife's house. And then I was in the back garden playing guitar. I had a guitar. And this voice came over the torrente, and it was this deep, dark voice. He said, "Hey, I like the way you play. Would you like to come over?" And there was this tall guy with floppy hair, who I didn't know from Adam. I didn't realise I'd seen him in Hyde Park a couple of years earlier, playing with the Rolling Stones. Didn't recognise any of that, and it was Kevin Ayres.
Wow. Interesting. So did you play with him? Did you go over?
I went over and we got in the car and he said, "We've got to get some food." And we drove to Soyer in this Renault 5, souped up Renault 5. And we met the boat coming in and we got some fresh gambas. And came all the way back. And then he said, "Can you cook egg fried rice?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I grew up in a kitchen." He grew up in a kitchen, apparently in Asia. And so he taught me to cook egg fried rice. And we had egg fried rice and gambas to sell it.
That was like your first time hanging out?
Yeah. And then he said, when I went into the house, the living room was just amplifiers and guitars.
Was he living here full time?
Yeah.
So wait a minute. You went from kind of being the lower guy on the totem pole in the pecking order of the macho community that you found yourself in.
Yeah.
Thing you know, you're hanging out with Kevin Ayers playing guitar and having fried rice.
Yeah.
That's a flex, Steve. And that's it.
And then he said we were going up to the bar in the evening after we'd eaten, and he played very simple guitar, very very simple guitar, and I think I was playing he had a beautiful Fender Telecaster and I was playing
nice.
We went up to the bar and he got absolutely wasted.
Not surprising.
And I remember saying to him, "You've got a great voice, man, but, you know, I'll play the guitar and you sing." I still didn't know who he was at all. So we're in the bar and I took the guitar off him, and another guy called Phil Shepherd started playing the bongos, and we all got really, really drunk. And then when we were wandering home, he said, "I'll see you tomorrow." He could walk. He had this long stride. Yeah? And I've got lots of stories about Kevin.
Yeah, what was he like? Was he a tall guy? Was he...
Have you never seen him?
I don't...
pictures?
I'm not sure. Well, yeah, but you know, in pictures, you can never really
tell. He was tall.
He was, I imagine, a tall guy.
He walked with a very long stride, and I'm short with short legs, and so he left me behind up and down the hill. And he was very polite, very kind, hugely intelligent. Hugely intelligent. Fascinating.
Wow. And where did he fit in? Was he relating? Was he hanging with all the other guys in the village? Or was
Kevin lived down at the bottom. I didn't realize that he... I didn't find out anything about him until about a couple of 3 days later as we were talking that he'd come back off tour with Jimi Hendrix and he'd done this and done that. And he said, oh, I've actually done 13 albums. And, yeah. And then slowly but surely... I think I was here for about 3 weeks in Toby's house and or Toby's mum's house. And people drifted in and out of his house.
So he was integrated into the community.
Well, musicians came.
Musicians.
From France. Oh. They came from Ibiza.
Wow.
They came from... These are people that were really well known.
And would you say there were, would you say that there was a dynamic music scene?
It was a huge
scene?
Dynamic.
Like, in terms of music?
Yeah, he's a kingpin. He was a linchpin of a particular genre of music.
And a kingpin.
Yeah, maybe. And he had a... One guy used to... One guy came in and just looked at me almost... My guitar playing with disdain. And then I heard him play. And it was a guy called Ollie Halsall, who's probably one of the best prog rock guitar players.
I was sitting
in the corner playing his guitar, and I think I would do the same.
Do you think? Well, no. So, I love guitarists like any woman.
Yeah.
Both of my sons are guitarists. I grew up around guys who play guitar. Yeah. My older brother plays guitar. Guitar playing is another kind of macho.
It shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be. But there is that thing. It's fascinating to me. It's kind of always so interesting to me how, even in the art world, even in the arts, men can bring their competitive natures into it.
But, yeah, and what... The reason I got on with Kevin, because I think I got on with him.
Hmm.
Because
I think you did.
Because he said to me, I like what you play and I like the way you play it, yeah? And Ollie would come in and sit in the corner and practice 1,000 miles an hour, stuff that I could never, even today, 40 years later.
So, like, what was it, electric? Was it
electric? Electric and acoustic, but he was very, very skillful guitar player.
Okay.
One of the very best, yeah?
Yeah.
And I can understand, because I'm a very slow guitar player.
Hmm, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I can't play fast.
Do you want to play fast?
No.
Okay.
No.
You can't play fast, but you've mastered your way of playing it. That's a very cool thing about guitar playing.
That's it. It's
just, everybody really has their own style.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, and I can't do competitive guitar work. The minute somebody starts riffing on top of me or away or riffing over the singer,
yeah,
I just shy away.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I think I have mixed feelings about it. There's a part of me that finds it very admirable and cool, and then there's a part of me that finds it very kind of like masturbatory. You know, it's kind of like, chill out, dude.
You're not Jimi Hendrix. You're not Paccadilla Thea, okay?
Exactly.
You are not John McLaughlin, okay?
Let's be collaborative here right now.
Let's work together. Let's get in the groove. Let's get in the groove, because it's the groove that people want to hear.
Yeah.
It's the groove that gets people dancing. It's the time.
That's right.
The timing.
And also the energy between the players. Like, if you're synergizing with the guys who are playing with you, that is the thing. That's like the click.
That's right.
And that's when the audience and the musicians start to become one.
Yeah.
Right? Then when you have the ego, as soon as the ego gets introduced into the equation,
it's lost.
Yeah, it is lost. It's funny how it shows up, though.
Yeah.
So that you must have seen so many interesting interpersonal dynamics play out through the music.
Here, yes, and again in my other life, in mature life in Norfolk, with the blues bands and the blues clubs and the folk clubs. Yes, until you get to a certain level.
Until you get to a masterdom
level.
That's right.
At which point nobody has got anything to prove apart from how they can develop the song and deliver it to somebody.
That's right.
Yeah?
Yeah.
We helped run a folk club in Norfolk, and we used to get people over from Appalachia.
I love that stuff.
Did the banjo players.
We used to go contra dancing all the time.
Yeah. But the masterdom of some of the people that came over, and you just wonder how they do it, but there's no ego. It's not ego. It's about,
it's transcendental.
It's
a meditation. When you're in the presence of a master, it is transcendental. You feel like this person is in a meditational state, and that something very powerful is happening.
Well, it's like if you, the first three notes of Samba Party, Santana.
Yeah.
You've only got to play it,
mm-hmm.
and the whole audience goes quiet.
That's right. Yeah.
It's three or four notes just strung together.
Yeah.
And
but you just
cuts
get a
straight
chill.
Through. Yeah.
You just get a
it's
chill.
Like Angie from Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
It just cuts through. So anyway, I had some really interesting times with Kevin, and became a really close friend, and he came to London to stay with us.
That's
and
great.
Introduced me to his daughter Rachel, and Gallen was knee high to a grasshopper running up and down the clot. This was the early 80s.
So he became a good friend.
Yeah, over 6 years we became really good friends.
And were you playing music together a lot?
I did when I came over here.
Okay.
Yeah,
he was also English. What part of England was he from?
I don't know. His music was from Canterbury and Kent. I mean, it's the Canterbury scene, yeah?
Okay.
But I'm not an expert on the Canterbury scene. There was Robert Wyatt, there was Kevin Ayres, there was Soft Machine. They weren't really my genre. I've always been a blues person, yeah?
Yeah.
Really basic blues. And one string blues, Lightning Hopkins and people like that, Robert Johnson. We became good friends, and he used to visit me and stay with me in London.
Uh-huh.
And
did you ever meet the guys from Led Zeppelin?
No.
Because they had a real bluesy kind of vibe going.
No, I've met some really interesting musicians in London, in Norfolk, and here. But never Led Zeppelin, no.
I have to ask. I'm a big fan. What do you think of Jimmy Page?
Yeah, he's a great guitar player.
He's amazing, right?
Great guitar player, master.
I think he's a master.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
so then what happened with Kevin? So you guys were good friends for 6 years, and then what happened?
I came out here one day. I'd been coming, I'd invited my parents out here, they'd stayed at the Esmer Lee, I'd got married and came out here, didn't last long.
Oh, rats.
There you go. Came out here with my wife, had holidays, visiting and staying. But then I came out one day, I think it was 1986, 1985, and I came downstairs. There was a room at the top of the house, of Kevin's house, if I was out here on my own, I used to stay in. And I came downstairs and I saw needles and wrappers in the ashtray. And I thought, this is not And they were out of it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say who was out of it, but they were out of it.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm going to go back to London. I'm going to go back to my business. I'm going to go back to sanity. Because this was fun. Mm-hmm. And I played several really nice, good fun party gigs with Kevin, where he'd actually, you know, said, come on, you know, one New Year's Eve gig with Natalia's father on drums and Pedro Colom on bass, and we were all dressed as girls, you know, two-tone miniskirt, eye makeup, oh, the whole thing, yeah. That was a New Year's Eve. Fabulous times. Mm-hmm. Used to go swimming out of the Cala. Kevin used to go scuba diving, and we used to go down in the morning. Met in London, Formosa Street, Maida Vale, that whole scene.
Yeah.
But then when you see people shooting up, and I wasn't long after that, I don't think, that Ollie, the guitar player, passed away.
That's a tough story. That's a tough part of the Dea story. That there's a part of me that would like to really delve into it, because I think it is a very integral part of the story, is the drug use and what was, you know, it's part of the light and dark.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's part of, like, people who are extraordinarily creative and brilliant can also be relatively tortured, can also be thrill seekers who are very attracted to experimentation with substances.
And it's also the loneliness. With Kevin, it was the loneliness. You know, he said to me once, if I'm not in love, I can't write a song. Yeah, and it was the loneliness. And also the self-deception that one can control an addictive substance. You know, having read Keith Richards' book about you should read
it. I need to read it.
How he controlled his heroin intake through the construction of several albums, and the quality of his heroin, the quality of the cocaine that he mixed it with and everything, the snowballs that they all used to do. And I've got a friend in who passed away about 4 years ago, who was in Dea at that time in 1979, and he was like 10 years older than me, and he was a friend of all the people. He was connected through different pathways, you know.
Yeah.
And we met in my village in Norfolk, and that was Todd, and he said, you know, that they used to mix their snowballs, and it was all good fun. And to me, it just scared me stiff.
Yeah.
And I thought,
it would scare me too.
Yeah. Yeah. Time to get out of here.
Yeah. That's kind of a line, right?
Yeah.
Where it becomes scary.
Yeah.
It's not fun anymore.
And also Dea was changing.
Yeah.
From the Dea that I knew.
That's right.
It was becoming
it was becoming bigger. More conventional too.
Yeah. Well, people were coming to Dea.
Yeah.
To be bohemian.
Quote unquote.
Quote unquote. Mm-hmm. But bringing lots of wealth and development with them.
And their idea of bohemian was completely different ballgame.
It was bo-chic.
It was it didn't have the guts and the craziness and the kind of risk-taking that the early bohemians had.
Also the cutting talent. The cutting edge talent.
I absolutely think that with that kind of exceptional brilliance that could only really, you know, I think like the first half of the 20th century was like, or the second half of the 20th century with, you know, the great wars, the depression, all of these epic things that happened in the world that impacted really the world. It birthed unbelievable genius, unbelievable art, and people who were extraordinarily tortured individuals. I mean, it's a certain level of human suffering births incredible, immense
out of
beauty.
Survival.
Yeah.
Survival comes through stress in life.
That's right.
Yeah. And when it's as people say, Einstein said, whether he did or not, I don't know, but it's not the strongest that will survive, it's the most adaptable.
That's right.
And the way out of a difficult situation is creativity.
And adapting and adaptation and finding a new way. Finding a new way to survive.
That's right.
To get up every day and have a purpose. And when society has let you down, you recreate. You recreate a society. I mean, this is such a microcosm of anti-establishment, bucking the system, bucking convention, you know, for a little period of time here. And so it's fascinating to me. That period of time is fascinating. I don't know where else you were going to find something that
I've never found it
powerful.
No.
And it started changing. So I think by the time I got here in 89, it was the beginning of the end. And I think towards the end of the 80s is when it started to kind of turn into a more, I mean, let's face it, like more of like a bougie vibe.
Yeah, yeah. And music changed.
Music changed. It became less complex in many ways.
Yeah.
The complexities of music changed because, you know, there was a lot of synthesis, a lot of production in studio.
Yeah.
And not to say that there's not some, I mean, I think great music came out of the 80s and the 90s, but yes, the quality of the music. The other thing too is the music and the art of the early 60s through, let's say, 1980. It was like revolutionary stuff. It was like progressions of early American music that then progressed into something epic.
Completely different. Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny that you say that you're really a blues man and you're into that early kind of blues vibe, because honestly, you really and truly give off American vibes. Like, I thought you were American for a really long time.
Really?
Yeah, like at least, yeah. The first time I saw you perform in Jane's, to me, you like really exuded this kind of American style and vibe.
Well,
it's
Dwayne Allman, Allman Brothers. It's because I spent my whole teenage years, you know, with different 78, you know.
You're strongly influenced by American culture and music. And yeah, so anyway, so that's how you got to Daya.
Yeah. And
you've had a light and dark experience here.
Yeah, most of it light.
Yeah.
Only the last week of the last week in the 80s, when I saw the needle and the people lying around the living room when I woke up in the morning, I think it's time to go, Steve.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I've been married and divorced and met somebody new and set up a business in England and, you know.
Yeah. You needed to get back to life.
Eric had gone to Nicaragua. I didn't know Tomas particularly well at that time at all. I'd stayed in his house and he was in the Pamboli band. And, you know, I knew when I first needed a guitar to play with Kevin, then Juan, Tomas's brother, loaned me his guitar for the night, you know. So I'd had some fabulous times.
I'm sure.
But I saw everything changing, and I had a really busy life in London, and I didn't come back really until 1999, 2000. I was away
for
14
years. You took a big break.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably not a bad idea.
And,
you know? I have this theory about Daya that you kind of have to go out. You know, Daya is so attractive in many ways, and it kind of lures you in. It's like a siren. I always say it's like a siren that can kind of like lure you in and then like smash you on the rocks. You have to go out into the world.
Yeah.
The larger world, I think, and not get sucked into the siren.
But by the time I came back, the big names had moved here.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, sure.
And the mountains had been built. Yeah?
Yep.
And the big names were here. The big names were there. And it was a fame circle.
Right.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And I remember walking up behind one of the big names up the street out of Cellini's bar one evening. And I said to this person, I said, did you know Kevin, or have you ever listened to any of Kevin's music? And the response from the well-known person was, who is a musician, No, and I've never listened to it. I don't really know of any reason why I should. So I said, well, that's the reason you're here.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't think we spoke again.
Well, I can understand. I think this happened a lot in the world. You know, after World War II, a lot of young Americans and a lot of young people kind of bucked the system and went into this bohemian artistic lifestyle. And but they lived hand to mouth. They were willing to be poor.
Yeah.
They were willing to not live with much, but they were very passionate about creating and making. And whenever you have a congregation of poor, starving artists, eventually the rich and the famous are going to show up.
Yeah.
It's just how it goes.
Because it's the place to be.
It's the place to be because it's the most interesting place. This is where all the intellectual activity.
It's the intellectual stimulation of the people that only care about their craft.
They don't care about the image. They don't care about the fame.
No.
And then I have this whole other side thing that I think about, but I don't know where I stand on it because I hear different things from different people. I always think that extraordinary fame impacts the psyche. It could really impact somebody's psychological state. And that's when you start to see the ego really come back. I don't know. I could be wrong. It depends on the individual, I guess. You know, each person's going to handle fame differently.
Yeah.
But the statement you just relayed, you know, really, really personifies that kind of like ego that comes into somebody who's that confident because they have this fame to back them up.
Yeah.
It would be an interesting thing to really look at and study across the board.
Yeah.
And that was the thing with Dea. Like, the originals didn't care about fame.
Well, they didn't. They were here to create.
Yeah.
They actually came here to escape.
100%. They came here because they were not comfortable in proper society. They needed a place where they can kind of throw spaghetti at the wall.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it be accepted and acceptable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why it became cool and then everybody moved in.
Yeah. And it has an amazing full moon as well.
Well, the nature here is... Well, I always say that the nature is one of the characters.
Yeah.
The nature of Dea is one of the characters of Dea. Yeah. It is its own thing. It has a massive impact on everyone who's here, whether they know it or not.
It does. It's remarkable. It's got an energy.
And it's unique. It's unique.
Yeah.
You've traveled, you know. I mean, I travel all over the place and I come back here and it always shocks me, the nature here. It always like makes me gasp.
Yeah.
You know?
Because it's so hard to change from season to season.
The colors, the vibrancy, the shapes, the mountains, the sea, the light in the sky, the plants, the trees. It's exceptional in so many ways.
And Eric told me when we were younger, and he grew up here, that this horseshoe of mountains has got the largest deposition of ferromagnetic rock in Northern Hemisphere. Which may be why we have this could be fantasy, but I remember him saying this to me, because I said, it's just such an amazing energy, this moon, it's literally drawing you up into the clouds.
I think there's a lot of lore. I mean, it would be really great to get a geologist to come in here and really come up with like a really solid scientific paper to say, this is what's going on here, this is what the rock, there's so many myths and stories about the nature of Dea. Nothing fully substantiated.
No.
A lot of vagaries.
Yeah.
A lot of like urban legend, which sounds great, but I would love to know. But on the other hand, right, there's also this thing, and I think we were talking about this the other day, you and I, in Death Cafe, which is sometimes you don't need the science to understand and have a profound understanding that something big is going on here. It's like, do I even really need scientific evidence to tell me that there's
Within yourself.
It's but it is a big thing here. It's fascinating. So I'm going to try to pull this back in because there's a lot of stuff I want to talk to you about. I know, but I mean, like, this is what I love about this. All right, so you made your way to Daya. So you grew up in, you tell me you grew up in like a very, very normal, regular kind of a household.
Yeah.
In the countryside of England?
Yeah, in a village in the countryside, yeah.
Sounds amazing. And you grew up by a medieval lake?
Yeah. It was a village called Brookman's Park.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, 14 miles from the boundaries of London, up the A1 into Hertfordshire.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a village that was owned by Henry VIII, yeah, with some follies that were never finished, and a golf course, and some natural lakes rising, and a woodland that was, huge woodland, that was, oh, it's Hertfordshire, it's beautiful, it's full of chalk streams and water rising up through the ground.
And it wasn't cut down or...
No.
So it's just, wow, sounds great.
And the lake that we used to fish and, you know, the park was landscaped by Capability Brown in the 1500s, 1600s, whenever Capability... It was a beautiful place to grow up. My grandparents came from Hertfordshire, further north in Nebworth, where Nebworth Park and the festivals were held. So we're Hertfordshire people.
Do you still go back?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Sounds amazing.
It is beautiful.
Do you think that's what influenced your scientific curiosity?
The lake did, yeah.
Yeah. So did you kind of know early that you wanted to get into the sciences?
No.
No?
Well, yes, but I wasn't very good at them. So.
Was it the math?
No, maths was never a problem. English was never a problem. just sitting exams where you're supposed to know things off by heart.
Yeah,
it was never very
not
good
a
for
great,
me.
Yeah.
So I think I got 3 O levels when I was.
Yeah, I think learning by rote is hard for certain types of people. For sure, I'm one of those people. I'm an experiential learner. I need to like touch the thing and be very So you started music when you were 12, which I think
is guitar,
I think there's a very, very strong link between music and science. I mean, music is somehow scientific and mathematical and how it's designed.
Sound waves.
Yeah, sound waves.
Frequencies.
Patterns.
Frequencies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you started playing guitar at 12?
Something like that, yeah.
And what compelled your parents? What compelled that?
No, there was a television program with a guy who played guitar. And he had a puppet called Wee Willem, and he used to play guitar, and I watched him since I was about 5 years old. But as soon as I got a job, I saved up and bought a guitar.
That's the best story. What was your first guitar?
My first real guitar was an Echo. No, I bought a six-string guitar from a second-hand shop, and I can't remember the name of it. The first decent guitar I bought was an Echo 12-string, because that's what George Harrison played on All Things Must Pass.
Do you still have it?
No. I loaned it to somebody, and that was the biggest mistake of my life. I loaned it to a dear friend whose house I've been living in. He's dead now, passed away. But I loaned it to my friend Sonny, who I was introduced to by Eric. And it went somewhere in West London and I never saw it again.
Rats. Well, if you're listening and you're in West London, be honest and return the guitar.
They wouldn't know.
But your very first was like a six-string beater.
Kind of.
So cool. Like, these are the stories you want to hear. When you're talking to a guitarist, these are the kinds of stories you want to hear. So you really picked up that six-string and really taught yourself?
Yes, and I was really lucky because in our village was not a normal village. It was a bit like a Daya in Hertfordshire, in the countryside.
Cool. So arty kind of...
It was cool. How can I say this? I know the history of the village now because I eventually, years later, I stayed in a farmhouse in Hampshire with the family who owned the village by pure...
Wow.
Coincidence, yeah,
mm-hmm.
when I was studying later in life. I said to Mrs. Bonsi, I recognise that lake you're standing by. And she said, oh, do you really? You know, my family used to own Brookman's Park.
Very English.
To which Colin said, darling, you don't need to tell him all these things. Anyway, within that village, there were some great musicians. The Kinks bought a house there.
I love the Kinks.
Donovan bought a house 5 miles away.
So it was a bit of a day.
It was a bit of a day. And in our pub, and in the pub in Welwyn Garden City, I remember being 14 and watching John Mayall playing Welwyn Garden City. You know, he just passed away. And Mickey Taylor was from Welwyn Garden City. It was a really creative area.
Let's say that amazing music was coming out of England.
Amazing. And there were three big, they were all on top of the pops, and they all lived in our village. It was quite a Jewish area.
Really?
Because, and the management, the production, the promotion, the golf clubs, the two golf clubs, you know, the open top Rolls Royces.
Are you Jewish?
No, I'm not, but I spent most of my life growing up amongst a Jewish pop, you know, between Totteridge, Potter's Bar and Brookman's Park. There's a whole community of very Jewish people.
That is not a community that exists in Daya, I can tell you that much.
There is
I think there's just like two Jews, maybe three.
Yeah. But anyway, it was really interesting. And
so you really grew up exposed to music, a lot of music,
creativity, people in the music business, people who were agents, people who were promoters.
That's very cool.
And
but you didn't like go that route ultimately. You went into science.
I went into science. I had an experience in London in the 80s. I had two lives. I was here, floating in and out, and I got a job in Germany as a fish farm manager. Having failed my degree, I still wanted to go into fish farming. So I got a job in 1982 in Germany and lasted 2.5 years and then learnt lots of skills about how to smoke fish and smoke salmon and do stuff. Went back to London and I thought, oh, if I have a little smoked salmon factory, I can play music and make money smoking salmon.
Smart. I mean, that's not a hard way to say.
It grew and grew and grew and grew and grew beyond my ability to manage it. And
good
it grew
for
15 years. And
so you managed to do the thing. You managed to do the thing where you had a streaming income and you can do your art.
Yeah, and then I had a streaming debt.
Well, that's what business owners.
1991, but it was, then my daughter, I separated from my daughter's mother and I ended up as a single parent. So in the 1990s, and I'd actually spent one recording session in a studio when I couldn't do what was expected of me. And that was embarrassing. That was 8 hours in a studio in Richmond trying to do stuff. And then this guy walked in from the studio next door who was actually the sound engineer and played what I couldn't play in 10 minutes.
Ooh.
And I thought, is this really my profession or is it just a love and a hobby?
You had to make that decision at one point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to.
You do.
Otherwise,
it's
you're going to starve.
That's right.
And your kid's going to starve.
That's right.
You know.
Yeah. But it's a conflict. It's definitely an artist conflict.
Yeah. So I set the business up and then that ran quite well and I sold it out when I ended up as a single parent and decided to go to Norfolk to live near my parents and because then we were all in the same village, mum, dad and my daughter and myself and had enough money to put myself through university for the second time.
That's respect. I have respect for that. And then you went on to, get a master's? And
a doctorate.
Wow, good for you. That's super cool. And you, but you majored in ecology. You focused on ecology.
I focused on ecology. I started on the aquaculture and fisheries management.
Yeah.
But then I got so disillusioned with the fake sustainability of fish farming.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was the way to feed the world.
Of course. It makes complete sense. I mean, people need to hear this, actually.
If you want to farm fish sustainably, farm fish that grow on vegetables. Farm tilapia. Farm something that does not consume from the carnivorous food chain, because it's a negative equation. Yeah? You only ever get 10% of what you feed. Yeah?
Right.
And 30% of that is thrown away as bones.
Right.
Yeah?
So that's not a money-making strategy.
Well, if you've got enough money, it is. But it's not sustainable for the environment.
No. And my understanding is that the fish that are raised that way wind up being very unhealthy.
They're not particularly healthy. If one goes into it in depth, in real depth, omega-3 to omega-6 fatty acid ratios, how they affect one's heart, the pre-feeding, the change of diet, the construction of the flavour of the fish for the American market. Like, you can't feed... when I was studying it in late 90s, one wouldn't wish to feed any seafood to a salmon that was going to be sold in America because it made it taste too fishy.
Yeah.
So you had to bring them off fish oils.
And feed them sugar.
And feed them sugar and rapeseed oil.
That's and when it becomes toxic.
I wouldn't say toxic, but that's when it becomes not as healthy as it should be. And also, I just thought, well, you know, the coastlines of the world, the mangrove swamps that are drying out, the pollution, the parasites, the parasite load, the viral load, the negative influence on naturally migrating fish, the escape populations, the genetic manipulation. And I became completely disillusioned with it. When I'd done my aquaculture fishery management degree, which was a brilliant degree, half practical, it gave me time to bring my daughter up and be with my mum and dad, etc. And play music.
Yes.
So I went for a job with the Environment Agency, and because I'd done an industrial phase of the degree,
mm-hmm.
and the head of my local Environment Agency said, "Oh, there's a master's degree at University of East Anglia. Maybe you can get on that, and then come back and work as a consultant," because he could see that I wasn't really corporate material.
Yeah.
Well, and he sold it to me like this. When I said, "Chris, do you think there's a job at the end of the summer?" He said, "Well, you get extremely well paid if you came back as a consultant. Why, you know, not there's a job in room number 5 for you."
Yeah.
Square peg, round hole.
Yeah. Now, the corporate route is very challenging.
Yeah, I've managed 3 months once.
I have experience with it. It takes a special kind of person, in my opinion, to do the corporate thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're clearly entrepreneurial. I mean, like, I'm getting very entrepreneurial vibes from you, that you like to be your own boss.
Yeah.
You're smart enough to kind of, like, do things your way.
But I like joining a team as well. And I like being part of, you know, I like being the
part of the band.
Part of the band, mm-hmm. you know. I never wanted to lead the band, you know.
Right.
But there was a fabulous master's degree at University of East Anglia in applied ecology and conservation, which was challenging. I think everybody else that got on the course had a first, and they came from all over the world.
Wow.
And I think I was the only one with a good 2:1 degree, yeah?
Yeah.
And that was a challenge.
Good for you.
Because suddenly you know, you're reading the quality of what other people are writing, and you're thinking...
I saw some of your articles. I think did you write all those articles?
Yeah.
You're a science writer.
Yeah.
Your science writing skills are pretty good.
Well, and then I got absorbed into the university. I wrote an essay for the master's degree on, believe it or not, for the School of Development Studies marked one essay, and I wrote it on the water sharing rights of Mallorca.
Super cool. All right, so we need to talk about this.
And then the guy there who marked that essay also worked for the World Bank, and he said, oh, I've got a project when you finish. Do you want to come and be my research associate?
Fabulous.
So I think that was 2002, mm-hmm. And I did 2 years for him, and we worked on a project on the Caroni River, which is the environmental impact of putting dams across the Caroni River, mm-hmm. on the fisheries and the Indian populations and the economics. And that was amazing.
It must have been incredible.
And luckily...
And this was on-site research, so you were there doing that? No.
I managed to avoid it. I desperately wanted to go.
Right.
But he flew out instead of me.
Okay. And he got all the data for you.
Well, no. I collected and analysed all the data.
Okay.
But the job was to go out there... and represent the university and this company called Adesla, who owned the electric development, you know, and it was a World Bank funded thing, it was £100 million. And they saw, instead of us being a benefit, they saw us as being a threat to their operation.
Of course they did. Yeah. Of course they did.
So they stuck him in a room in a dam on the end of the, in the middle of the river, and wouldn't let him out for 3 weeks. So. And I was sitting at home.
What?
I was sitting at home doing all the writing. And he was phoning me up saying, I'm still here. They won't let me off the dam. Anyway, I have a beautiful book on the Caroni River that he brought back that was signed. And then as that contract came up, the Environment Agency of England then wrote into the several universities advertising a project. They wanted to find out why the habitat range of primeval structured algae called chorophytes was disappearing across the United Kingdom. And somebody had written a paper saying it was excess phosphorus, and they wanted that hypothesis tested. So I wrote a proposal for my professor, mm-hmm. who was happened to be head of the school,
mm-hmm.
and... We won the bid, and then I got 4 years going around England sampling lakes.
Testing water.
Yeah, 900 freshwater bodies.
It's amazing.
Comparing and contrasting.
Yeah.
And measuring the health of all the plants within them.
Super interesting. And that is fascinating.
Testing it in a laboratory by mm-hmm. taking the groups of plants and dosing them. And finding out, and we found out.
Did you prove the phosphorus theory?
Disproved it.
Disproved it. So what was the problem?
The problem's nitrogen.
Too much nitrogen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that from
like runoff and stuff?
Yeah, it's from runoff. It's from runoff from...
farming, agriculture.
Yeah.
Wow.
But so phosphorus is a problem, but it doesn't physically damage the plants. It creates green water, which shuts down the light.
Yeah.
But nitrogen, we found, does physically damage and restrict the growth of these algae, these structured algae.
Why? Because it's like suffocating? Like, is it reduces oxygen?
It causes oxidative stress within the chloroplast, so they can't actually photosynthesize. And it also damages the root development, and we don't know why. And unfortunately, somebody... I took longer than I should to write the thesis because I didn't want anybody else to finish it. But we did get that paper published, and it's quite a seminal paper.
Really?
And the head of the Environment Agency, who was a phosphorus man, walked past me at one of these conferences and said, I have a significant disinterest in your research.
Wow.
And the head of another department, because my reason I'm so sensitive to the word toxic, my professor wanted to put the word toxic into the paper, and I wanted to use the words detrimental to this group of species.
Right.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's way more specific and way less universal.
Yeah.
Right.
But publicity-wise, to say the waters of this group of lakes are toxic.
Panic, fear, terror.
And our funding got cut off.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And so... But it was a great time, and I ended up spending...
It's a testament to how political science actually is.
Science is really
political. Once you're practicing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that research allowed me a career that went on till 2016.
Wow, very cool. So one question, just like a side question, because we have this in the United States. Is there fish kill in England, in the lakes? There is. So you guys... And is that from this problem?
It's general. Fish kill is usually through lack of oxygen.
Right.
They die.
Right.
Okay. At night, if you have eutrophic waters, those with high levels of phosphorus and nitrogen, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The algae that grow during the day and photosynthesize and turn green, and the water goes green. Yeah. Those algae at night, they don't give off oxygen. Photosynthesis reverses.
Oh.
They give off carbon dioxide.
Oh, that's awful.
Carbon dioxide acidifies the water. The acidification of the water reduces the ability of the fish to extract oxygen from the water through their lungs.
Wow.
It imbalances the pH of the fish blood.
So they're literally suffocating.
So they suffocate. Oh, and they all die en masse.
Wow, yeah, okay.
And millions will die
within... And it's typically linked to, like, agriculture.
Yeah, it's
runoff, agricultural runoff.
Runoff and sewage.
So do these articles lead to any kind of governmental changes, like in policy and law?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I did one on anti-fouling paints on boats on freshwater lakes, shallow lakes, and that challenged... the manufacturer of a particular anti-fouling paint to withdraw from applying for a new license, which is great.
It's great. Yeah.
And there is now a huge anti-nitrogen lobby in freshwater systems in the United Kingdom.
Congratulations. That's epic. That's a big game changer. Super cool. The power of science, right?
The power of...
good science.
Evidential science.
Evidence. Yeah.
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 We didn't prove anything.
Right.
Okay. This is... we just provided evidence, enough evidence.
To suggest that this is what's happening.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. How interesting to be a scientist in these days.
I think so, because...
It is.
Yeah. What surprised me the other day was... the anti-science lobby in the group of friends that we were with.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I was really shocked. I was stunned that people could just write scientists off as a group of people who were operating for their own personal benefit.
Mm-hmm.
That really, really shocked me.
It is shocking. I mean, I think the me of like 10 years ago would be shocked because I'm such a believer in the benefits of science and how important scientific inquiry is.
Yeah.
It's epically important. I do really believe that through science we have learned so much. It's clear. But since COVID and the kind of whacking, like when you can see how heavily influenced by politics science is, you're gonna absolutely question science. You're gonna start questioning it, and that really boils down to more than science. It boils down to the ethics of science. It's like, Is science being carried out ethically? What are the ethical principles of how that should be done? And absolutely positively, I can say that I believe that maybe, for example, the pharmaceutical company might have science backing up products or things
for their own benefit.
For their own benefit, that might actually not be ethically carried out science. I mean, I think you can come up with a hypothesis and prove it.
Or disprove it.
Or disprove it, right? Using statistical inquiry and all that kind of thing. So it's an interesting thing, and I think I love how you framed that it's not about proof, it's about evidence. And I think if we can look at science that way, and everybody sees science that way, it makes complete sense, because then the science has the flexibility in the room to change its mind, as science will do based on current evidence. It doesn't matter what the evidence was 10 years ago. If there's more evidence that disproves that, that can kind of like layer over it, you can change the answer.
But there's human nature as well as in science, isn't there? There is ego. There is profit. There are career paths.
Ambition. Money.
Huge amounts of money.
Tons of money. Yeah.
And, I mean, just from a personal point of view, there are one paper written against me, published, and against our work, not me, our work, by a major chemical company. And as soon as our paper was published, which is irrefutable, evidence, if you take 1,000 of these plants and you dose them systematically and you've got 100 replicants, and you do the job properly, Now, they ran the same experiment and got no results.
Right.
Yeah. And they published that within 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's been happening a lot in science lately.
And that happens a lot in science.
Yeah.
Recently.
It really does.
Yeah.
And that's why I think you have people now, and there are many different areas of science in which this is happening. So, like I said, my allegiance to science was almost unflappable. Like, I was so allegiant to the scientific approach. I needed scientific proof for anything.
Yeah.
And now I'm realizing, because, we watched what happened during the COVID years, and you start to understand that, wow, there's a big, huge machine behind this operation. There's so much money to be made one way or the other. We're living in this post-industrial society that it's very corporatized. The lobbying is immense. I mean, it's a very, very powerful machine that So if you're a scientist,
are you telling the farmers of the United Kingdom not to put nitrogen on the, or saying that every single field should have a nitrogen or a runoff ditch around it? Hey guys, nitrogen's costing you money. You're buying it by the ton and you're putting it into the river because only 10% is getting used by your plants.
Right.
So why not recirculate the water that you're putting on, you're irrigating onto your plants with the nitrogen that's already dissolved into it?
100%. Come up with smart solutions.
Same with phosphorus.
Come up with smart solutions. Unfortunately, from my perspective, because science is so political, this whole pathway towards smart solutions moving forward is so stymied by how political science has become. Because there's a money-making machine behind that. And as long as people are profiteering off of something, they don't want to go smart.
Easy profit.
If you have a long, easy profit. People who want to just make money now, who have absolutely no vision for the future, they're just gonna put out bad science. And they're gonna like cut off, and the scientists who are really ethical and really do want to solve the problem are gonna be silent. But that's the history of science too. Throughout history, there's always been that scientist who was naysayed and humiliated by the greater scientific community, and then wound up being totally right in their hypothesis.
Yeah,
that's so common. That's humanity. It's guitarists too. Guitarists are the same way.
Yeah. Not all.
Very, very, very interesting. So I want to touch a little bit about your relationship with Tomas, because Tomas Graves, who is well known, very well known in Love in the Data community as well. You guys have done some music stuff together.
10 years now.
Okay. Are you still, so it's a kind of current ongoing
We played
project?
3 gigs in the last month.
Super cool. And you're playing everywhere? Like, are you just playing
This is part of me being shy. I am a salesman. So a few years ago, you know, I was out hustling gigs. But this happened. Tomas will explain this. I'm sure you're going to speak with him. But I was... the last 20 years, I've been with a Mallorcan lady who lives in Sawyer, who Tomas knew from, has known a long time. And in 2000, and how does this start? 2014, Eric,
The infamous Eric.
The infamous Eric, Daniel Alegría, okay. Grandson of Daniel Alegría, okay, who you will meet.
I will meet him.
Eric called my partner Trinidad and I up and said, I'm coming to the island. This is 2014. I'm getting married. So I said, again? So he said, we're going to have a great big wedding in the middle of the island. And I had been with my Mallorcan partner for 14 years at that time.
So side question, just sorry to interrupt, but do you speak Mallorcan?
Not very well, no. Okay. So I should do. That. Anyway, right. I should do. I do some, enough to get
so
by.
So was your relationship in Spanish or English?
It was in English and Spanish, but mainly in English because she's a fantastic linguist. Okay. She speaks 4 or 5 languages.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Anyway, so Eric's coming back to Mallorca. Mm-hmm. I've been in England since 2001. My partner had been in England with me. She was at school with Tomas and she was at school with Eric. Mm-hmm. She's Mallorcan. Mm-hmm. Very old Mallorcan
family.
A Sawyer
girl. A
Sawyer
girl.
Yeah. And so I'd heard Tomas playing acoustic guitar. With the Pamboli band, he played bass, and I'd heard him play acoustic guitar on a couple of occasions, and I thought, wow, this guy's seriously good, At the same time, and I think I'd seen him in, you know, a couple of occasions between 2010 and 2014. At the same time, there was a film being made here in the Puerto de Soya and in Dea. It's some very famous people on a boat, And Tomas, because of his artistic connections, was invited and offered a spot as an extra on the film. So there was another friend of Tomas called Gus Pollard, who used to have a boat in the Port of Sawyer, who married Fliss Templeton. David Templeton's ex, And Gus had bought a piece of land on the end of the piece of land that Tomas had run away to with Carmen in Poreras, from Dea, And they both got jobs as extras on this boat. This is a long story.
It's a great story.
They both got jobs as extras on this boat. Gus is a fabulous singer. And so... they entertained the other extras during downtime by playing sea shanties and folk songs. Tomas would bring his guitar and Gus would sing. And there were pictures of them dressed as you know, like crew members on an old boat. So they had a set of music. And when Eric's wedding came round in 2014, somebody said to me, Tomas is going to go to the wedding. And there's another great guitar player here. My first night here of playing guitar, looking back, was not with Kevin. It was with two guys called One Bibiloni and Pepe Milan. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's when I first met my partner of 20 years at a jam session down in Mulcalcali in Pepe's flat.
So cool. That had to be a blast.
Well, yeah, yeah. I'm a folk guitar player from Plymouth, and you know, and suddenly I take a guitar and I'm sitting with Juan Babiloni and Pepe Milan, and I'm thinking,
that's a huge deal.
Yeah, I'll just pretend. Just sit in
that's a corner. Fake it till you make it.
Yeah, I'll fake it till I make it. Yeah. And the next night was with Kevin, but that was the first night.
Oh,
my first night, because Eric had taken me there.
What an epic early introduction to Dea for you.
Yeah, yeah, epic. My first jam session, Pepe Milan and Juan Babiloni. So anyway, Pepe Milan was also coming to the wedding because they're all friends, you know, from school days. So I just phoned, I got Thomas's phone number and said, hey man, I'm going to crash your gig because I don't want to sit at a wedding all night, you know, just drinking and, you know, speaking Catalan.
Small talk. And
yeah. Do you mind if I bring a guitar? And he said, no, Pepe's also bringing his guitar. So I thought, well, that's okay. That's cool. We'll see what can happen. And at Eric's wedding, and his son is getting married in Dea at the end of August, so that's why they're all coming up. At Eric's wedding, we started playing at about 9 o'clock at night and finished at about 4 in the morning.
Wow. Fantastic. Super, super cool. Any video? Any video footage of that?
There may be.
That's so sweet.
But that was Pepe playing jazz, and Pepe and I swapping licks, because I'm blues and he's jazz, and he's going, oh, you're always finding the note, aren't you? And I'm going, well, you know, you're finding lots of notes. And Thomas was playing the most beautiful acoustic guitar. And then about a week later, apparently Thomas had gone home and said to Gus, I think I found somebody to join the band.
Super cool story. Anyway, and the band is called?
Thomas Congas y Steve Adamas.
That's amazing.
Well, the Adamas is because I'm not always there, and I couldn't always be there.
You hop in and out.
I hop, and yeah, now I literally will fly in for a gig.
Super cool. Because I gotta come to a gig. When's your next gig?
I think we're playing in Dea on the 26th of August.
I'm there.
Yeah.
At Safonda?
No, I think it's for, Thomas has mentioned it to me, it's for celebration of Ondine Perez's life.
Oh, how beautiful. Yeah, that's beautiful. Very cool.
So I'm going to fly in for that.
I'm going to definitely come and see you play.
Yeah.
But for what a beautiful cause. And it's such a community-based thing. That's super cool.
So that's how we got together, and we've gigged ever since.
It's great.
And we did have a couple of 3 years before lockdown where we were gigging every other weekend.
Wow. It's wonderful.
And it's great. Now we just close our eyes and play.
Yeah. I mean, you guys can finish each other's phrases.
Yeah.
Super cool.
Cool.
So let me ask you a question. Do you feel like your connection to Dea and being in Dea impacted your interest in the science? Did it kind of overlap into your scientific mind? Like, how about the water situation here? I feel like you're a guy who knows water.
Yeah.
So anything about the...
Well, it got me my first job at the university, writing about the water-sharing system of Mallorca and the hills of Fornalutx, where you have to go up every Monday and swap your water... Your sequia. I was going to make a spreadsheet because in Thomas's book, A House in Mallorca or A Home in
which
Mallorca,
I'm currently reading,
there he sent me 6 pages in case I got asked questions during this interview. the correct names for the correct bits, you know, the sequiona, the sequia, the this, the that, the other.
Well, first of all, let's just explain to anybody listening that water is a massive deal on the island. I mean, water is a big deal, period. But this is an island that has some wet months in the winter.
Yeah.
But then is dry and in a state of drought during the growing season, which is, you know, spring through summer, mostly through summer.
Yeah.
And the Arabs, my understanding is, my vague understanding or limited understanding is that the Arabs had created some amazing water systems here.
They had. They did. And, okay. So, basically there are two types of water. There's the water that falls on the mountains, and there's the water that falls on the flatlands. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Most of the mountain range here is calcareous, calcium.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And most of the rain that falls is slightly acidic.
Hmm.
Yeah?
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, well, rain is acidic.
Well, yeah, yeah, okay.
And by the time it's mixed with sulfur and car fumes.
But is it like, so it's particularly, is it particularly acidic or is it better pH 6, average?
Okay. pH 6 versus, you know, fresh water, normal fresh water is pH 7. So, rain is quite acidic.
Okay.
Yeah. Depending upon where it's blown from. Okay. Comes across these mountains and, as explained in the book, it will fall on the mountains, and slowly but surely it will carve its way, dissolve its way, and create in-mountain lakes. So within these mountains, at various levels, there are lakes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the fissures within the mountain, the water finds its way out as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And the water that falls on the flatlands goes down into the aquifer. Yeah, so you've mm-hmm. got mountain lakes, inner mountain lakes, and you've got aquifers under the flatlands.
Mm-hmm.
The Arabs created a system for each type of water. Yeah,
yeah,
of cutting in to the mountain to find the lake, and then, or finding where the water is drizzling out of a mountain and then boring into the mountain. I think in Thomas's book he said one of these near Sao Paulo goes 600 meters underground with air holes coming down so that the miners, the water miners, could breathe.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a series of different constructions to channel the water as it comes out of the mountains and or raise the water up. As we go onto the flatlands of Mallorca, we see the water mills.
Yeah.
Yeah, which are there to bring the water up from the aquifer.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Into those big safarach that they have. Yeah. Yeah.
And there is also an underground source of water, which if one was a blood chemist, or like, I'm a water chemist, so I see water as chemical soup. I see profiles of water.
Mm-hmm.
All the different micronutrients and ions in a water sample will tell me where it's been, where it's come from, you know, what it's absorbed, what it's dissolved out of, you know.
Yeah.
Serpentine water will have a completely different profile to calcareous water, marble. And there are a couple of springs on this side of the island, mm-hmm. one in Soyer,
mm-hmm.
and I think one somewhere along this north coast, where the water profile is exactly the same as the snow melt in the Pyrenees. And the belief is that it goes, the water rises here
mm-hmm.
in the fonts 5 to 6 months after the snow melt in the Pyrenees.
Whoa.
So it goes what? Under the, because.
That's wild.
Because these islands were pushed up from the seabed.
So they're just ginormous pathways under the.
Underneath.
Ground, under the
mountains. Under the Mediterranean.
Wow.
Bubbles up in these mountains. So there are three sources of water.
Amazing.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Now, the Arabs, they dug down into the mountain. They dug sideways into the mountain. And on the steps, the bancals, yeah,
mm-hmm.
they... and I helped during COVID restore one of these systems completely from start to finish with one of your other interviewers, Jaime Salas.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
He sent, yeah, Jaime actually crawled up the tunnels. It was quite fascinating.
And I don't want to get too into this because I think it would be a very in-depth conversation, but do people know how these were built, like how the Arabs pulled it off? How did they pull that off?
Just hard work and slave labor. Yeah.
Digging in and digging in and digging in and
following the water and following the water. And some people are lucky. Like there's a guy in Fornalutch who's bought an olivar.
Mm-hmm.
He's from Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
And between the 1st of April and the 28th of May,
mm-hmm.
Or they call it the 40th of June, which is the 10th of May, yeah? between those days,
mm-hmm.
on his land comes the most beautiful water I've ever seen. It just comes out of a little archway in a bancal.
Mm. Amazing.
And feeds four plots of land, four huge, 67 acres of land.
That's amazing.
Yeah? And then it stops. Then it starts and it stops, and it's all to do with pressure within the mountain.
Okay.
But the water quality is drinkable unless people are putting bothanegras in the way. I tried to do the calculation yesterday for this discussion, and I got lost in zeros.
Wow. Yeah. I bet.
Because 50 centimetres per square meter of rain falls
mm-hmm.
on this land during the year, and I did the mathematics, but I got lost in zeros. But if you've got 1 million people on mm-hmm. this island,
mm-hmm.
yeah, at any one time,
yeah,
900,000 mm-hmm. plus 100,000 tourists, right. or whatever, call it 1 million,
yeah,
and they all need on average 500 liters of water a day, half a cubic meter. You got 500 million litres of water a day.
Yeah.
500 million litres of water a day required without the tourist industry.
Yeah. In a hot climate.
And I bring this back to Daya.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'll bring it to any town, any village within here. Yeah. But the huge development in Daya of these multi-million pound houses, yeah, nobody's built a reservoir, and they sell the water to other towns from the Font de Dea.
I know.
This astounds me. How you can spend 50 million on five houses and not build yourself a reservoir.
Yeah.
And for the future, the first thing the Arabs would have done is build the reservoir.
I don't think people understand the water thing when they come here. I think when you're a foreigner, look, me, I'm going to give myself an example. When I came here for the first time in 1989, my mind was blown by what I had to do to conserve water. Like, I had never lived like that before. I grew up in New York City, turned the tap on.
Yeah.
You could take a 15-minute shower. This was just normal life. Like, being told that I had to turn the water off while I was brushing my teeth, like little things that you don't even think about, that you just take for complete granted in places where there's water. And then you're here. I have learned how to live off so little water.
Yeah.
Most of the water I use now really is just to drink.
Yeah.
To stay hydrated.
Yeah.
But there's just no consciousness around it. It's so easy to come here as a tourist, go stay at one of the fancy hotels and have zero clue about the water situation.
My second trip here, I didn't have anywhere to stay. We stayed at Kanket, which is on the way. Yeah. At the time, it was rustic.
Yeah, I'm sure. That's been great.
If you wanted a shower,
mm-hmm.
you had to hit the pipe, right, from your room
Yeah.
And somebody would run to the other end of the hotel and turn a tap.
Ah.
So that we got shower water in the house, in the room.
Uh-huh.
And one could only, if I remember, one could only shower in the evening.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it hit the pipe again.
Huh?
Clang, 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 and they'd run along and they'd
turn. And it
might have
just been like a trickle of water, too.
That's right.
Now you're like really got a reason. Well, no, I mean, there were like amazing stories. I mean, there's amazing history about water wars.
Yeah.
And water rights warfare amongst neighbors. I mean,
yeah.
There's some great stories over on the other side of the village. There's a talk that I did with Tony Ripoy. He's one of the elders, one of the Mallorcan elders of the village.
Yeah.
And he talks about in his old house, he was the first Spanish family to live in that land after the Moors.
Okay.
So it was like 1352 or something like
that.
Yeah. And he talks about how the top floor and the bottom floor come from completely different water sources.
Yeah.
And then he talks about some argument that his family had with neighbor, you know, like just stories about the water. It's fascinating. Like, I wish somebody would write a big, giant, comprehensive book in English, please,
okay,
so I can read it, about the history of water in Mallorca.
Okay.
It would just be a fascinating read.
Well, it's still going on because the guy that I talked about in Fornalutx, the fortunate man, yeah?
Yeah. His neighbors hate him.
No, his neighbors,
uh-huh,
he doesn't want to upset them.
Right.
But only two out of his four neighbors now receive the water from their escritura. The other two asked me to look into it. And when I got involved, you have to go back through two mayors and two town administrators, and then one becomes extraordinarily unpopular.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no.
Because one's asking questions.
You can't. There's stuff like that in Daya, for sure.
So I then suggested, I said, hey, guys, let's have a community water restoration project. Putting a positive spin on it. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's not go into who's done what. Let's have a restoration project where we can all go back to how we were.
Don't look at the past. Look at the future.
Yeah.
And you can be. The stories are interesting because it is interesting, once again, how humans will be about things.
You wouldn't believe how quiet it has gone since that suggestion was put forward.
That's hilarious.
And I just backed off.
If you're going to go into that, then it's like...
Back off.
Sometimes I think in situations like that, it's better finding a backdoor solution that nobody has to know about.
Well, that's what the owner of the owner of the Lucky Chap has finally said, look, I'll deal with this.
Just go in.
Because it's my water.
Go get your water, man.
Yeah,
I'm not even saying anything about it. But that's the thing. I would, for me personally, if I could ever find that one person who could just spend 2 hours just talking about the water.
Yeah.
And do a whole history and then intricate explanation of the water systems into the histories and to some of the really interesting feuds that have taken place on the island, that would be one heck of a great podcast talk, in my opinion.
Oh, there's a guy that came to Fornalutx. He's Mallorcan, and he gives tours of the Fuentes.
Super cool.
Find his number. He takes English people up there.
For sure.
I would spout forth, but I don't know enough.
That you are a water expert, and so I know that you have some vague understanding. I mean, better than mine. Other, you know, me, I know the canals and I know the beautiful little piping systems that we see when we're walking.
And I've restored whole systems.
It's amazing.
But that's it.
Right.
But there is the information, and there are a group of people who are experts in the
it's a beautiful
thing. Mallorca. So
it's a beautiful history. It's a fascinating history. Yeah, I mean.
And is it the same in Menorca? Is it the same in Ibiza?
I would love to know. I'm not sure. Probably not.
I'm sure
it's different. I don't know. It's a great question. I mean, the Balearic Islands are fascinating. You know, the nature varies. It's very variant. Who knows? Does the water from the Pyrenees also go to those islands?
No idea.
You know? Be interesting to know.
Okay.
I'm curious. All right. Somebody write the book, please.
Okay.
All right. This could be 5 hours, Steve, because you're an interesting guy.
5 hours?
Oh, yeah. Like, we just keep going. Which actually is my dream. Like, I like these long format conversations because you could talk about everything in a real way. But let's go to my other question. So, you have definitely seen Mallorca change since 1979.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah.
So, going forward, going into the future, what would you like to see? What do you think needs to happen to optimize life in Mallorca for everyone and the environment moving forward?
Well, that's a deep question. I would suggest that people come to Mallorca because of the environment. Yeah?
Yeah.
And we've had this, there is a whole science now called the economics of the environment. Yeah? And unless one conserves the environment, then the environment will change. If the environment changes, then the use of it will change, and the type of people and that come here, and the number of people will change. So, yeah, it's a knock-on effect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So I think it's very difficult. The Mallorcan people very much want to protect their culture.
And they have every right to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because without their culture, there is no Mallorca as...
That's right.
Which is what we escaped to.
Yeah.
I mean, why am I here and not in London?
Yeah.
Why am I here and not in the Brexit fields of Norfolk? Yeah.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Which are equally beautiful.
Yeah.
But full of people who think differently.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
They make great bread there and they make great bread here. Yeah. But it's the culture here. And I think the Mallorcan culture needs protecting.
Agreed.
From,
outside influences.
It needs protecting and it also needs promoting.
Yeah.
I would like to see more cross-border teaching, Mallorcans teaching us, yeah, about their culture, yeah, and reaching out to us because... I think there's a growing frustration and a divide. Mm-hmm. You know, the giddies and the non-giddies.
Right.
Yeah. Are you?
Which is understandable. I mean, it's very complicated. First of all, I want to say this is my perspective on it. I don't blame tourists for wanting to come here. People are going to want to come here. Tourism is a big issue. Being an expat and coming here is a big thing on the island. I understand that people want to come here. And I don't blame them. But I do blame the governance around how that's done. I think that the governance around how things are done should be reconsidered. And I think that comes from that the Mallorcans are going to have to...
I don't think it's in the control of the Mallorcan people. And then we get down to, you know, divorce from Madrid...
Right.
I don't think it's in the hands of many of the Mallorcan people. And I think Mallorca is an island, like many places in the world, that is controlled by a limited number of families. The decisions are made not in Parliament. The decisions are made over Sunday lunch in the possession.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one up from the finca.
It's a mafia. You're basically saying it's a mafia.
Well, I'm saying it's like the school committee, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you try and you go to your parents' and children's meeting and you find the decision's already been made over coffee.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you try and voice
which is probably how things had been done for centuries.
And it's the way things are done all over
but
the world.
But now with this extensive
stuff going on. We do have huge tourism here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It is impossible for a bike rider to feel safe, and it's impossible for somebody in a car to get from A to B in the time they expect to get there.
That's right.
Yeah. The buses, for me, on the narrow roads are too big.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Yep.
They need to be more frequent and smaller buses.
I totally agree with that. Yeah.
This is just my viewpoint.
I agree.
My perspective. The water situation needs desperately addressing because so much water goes into the sea every winter, cascades into the sea. Yeah. Now, that's very good for coastal ecology, maintaining the balance of coastal ecology.
That's right.
But there's nothing wrong with interrupting it on the way and saving a bit because the sea levels are rising anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So.
No, that's right there is a very practical solution.
And in terms of, I don't know about atmospheric pollution. I know in the town that I live in most of the time, Sawyer, the air quality is appalling because the various arguments because of mass traffic, burning of no traditional methods of land management that have now been put into Airbnb gardens.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We all used to burn in the olivar to save the trees, all used to burn on the orange groves to save the bugs and refertilize the land.
Mm-hmm.
But now the gardeners have got 4 hours to get in and get out
right.
and burn all the waste.
Yeah.
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 That sort of thing. Where would I like to see Mallorca go, or how could it go somewhere for the better? It needs to concentrate on sustainable principles.
Yep, I agree.
And in order to sustain something, one needs limits. And that sounds, that's almost fascist, because who's going to make the limit? Who's going to draw the line? Whose rule is going to be right? Yeah?
Yeah.
Turning the Tramontana mountain range into a UNESCO World Heritage Site has not been used for the protection of the site. It's been used as an advertising campaign.
I agree.
In my view.
I agree. No, I think it's very doable. I actually think that solutions are actually very doable if everybody's willing to do them and actually could make an immense change. I think somebody, I don't know who the people are who makes that happen. Maybe I need to get invited to like some Sunday paella and talk to some people. But I think it's all very doable stuff where it could actually be a win-win for tourism and economy, but also the ecology here. I think it could be a win-win situation, and I agree. The kinds of regulations needed would enhance the visitor's experience, will enhance the life of the Mallorcan people, will celebrate the lives of the Mallorcan people. It's so doable. And I guess what's frustrating to me is somebody who feels like I really have no say one way or the other. But to me, it all feels very doable. And I feel like there's just such a lack of real will and cohesiveness around it that's what surprises me.
Well, it breaks down at the point at which somebody's 3-hectare farm plot suddenly is within the rural boundary and not in the agricultural boundary when the boundaries change and somebody's suddenly worth 6 million. It breaks down at that point.
Yeah, sure does.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
It breaks down at the point
on every level. Yeah.
Somebody makes a massive profit.
Yeah, that's right.
And they're huge. Rapid, massive.
And they jack up the cost of land, and then local people can't afford to live in their own land. And no, it's a whole big cycle. Listen.
And I think limitation on the ability of people to buy property here unless they've been resident for a certain period of time.
Yeah.
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 Would help so that, if granny dies in England and leaves you $500,000. Which is quite common.
Yeah.
You don't just pop down to Sawyer and buy a 4-bedroomed house that's empty for 9 months of the year.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, also,
all that sort of thing. That's a bit biased. No.
I mean, listen, it's an endless conversation. I believe there's solutions. I believe there's just some fundamental, basic things that could be done just to start.
Yeah.
That could greatly improve things on the island. I also think there needs to be a big, big, big shift in how tourism is framed, because Mallorca and Mallorcan culture is so, so, so much more than going to the beach and having a holiday. It is a sophisticated culture with a long history, with excellent food, excellent wine, great people, great music. And that is the reason why people should be coming here, in my opinion. And I also think that if you are a hotelier, if you are a person who's going to open up a hotel or something that brings tourists in, you need to honor the Mallorcan culture when you do that.
Yeah.
I really believe in that. I think because the culture is shockingly interesting and fascinating, doesn't get celebrated the way it should be. I always say that France and Italy did a kick-ass job in promoting their cultures.
Yeah.
And I think we need something like that in
I think you're right.
Mallorca and broader Spain.
Yeah, I think you're right, because otherwise we're just being, you know, ice cream shopped out of existence.
Yeah, then it just becomes like, I don't really want a Louis Vuitton on Calle de la Luna. I want like these small artisanal shops that are very Mallorcan that rock. Like I'm not coming here to see big box names or fancy
anywhere.
Anywhere, any airport in the world. And I'm not coming here to be in like a, you know, an all included hotel. Like I'm coming here because I want to stay in like an old, cool, rustic finca that has the super cool Mallorcan aesthetic and eat a darn good tumbet and drink some great local wine. Like, there's so much here culturally to offer everyone. And I think that somehow that got lost in the, you know, translation.
It's getting slowly but surely dissolved in the mix.
And I want all of my Mallorcan friends and their kids to have that next generation having that tribal
experience. They do
try. No, they make a great effort. I mean, I think in Daya, it's amazing. The effort here is amazing.
And in Sawyer, too.
Yeah,
in
Sawyer is like, I love Sawyer so much.
Yeah.
All right, well, listen, we can go on forever, but and I'd like to, but I'm going to move us through my other questions. Okay. Now we're going to move into like my fun questions.
Fun.
Yeah, you're real fun. This is the fun part. What is your absolutely favorite thing to do on a free day?
Here.
Anywhere.
Anywhere. My favorite thing to do. Well, I had two things that I have to do, which is walk the dog morning and night. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love walking him in the mountains. That's great. Especially on hot days, because he can go through the sekkies and paddle. Yeah, because I know where they are.
Adorable.
I go to a little beach in Palma, which is near the airport that nobody has bought up around, which is old 1930s beach, and it's full of Majorcan people, and one can walk out up to one's neck 50 metres out. And so
sounds
I'm not going to say where that is.
Don't say.
No.
I'm glad you know where it is that you're enjoying it.
And I love it. And play some guitar and have a jam session. And I'm very, very fortunate that people come here. And, you know, I know a lot of people that come and go from... And so they arrive, and at some point during their 2-week stay, they'll pick up the phone and say, "Should we have a jam? Do you want to come round?"
Perfect. Yeah.
So I spend most of my time
jamming with random people.
Jamming with random people and friends, and going to the beach and walking the dog.
Sounds like a good.
And read,
sounds perfect.
And in the evening, I try to read books. You know.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, now.
Okay.
We go into my quick fires.
Okay.
All right. This is where I give you a choice of two things, and you have to pick one.
Okay.
And we'll see how it goes.
Right.
There are no real hard rules on this. So.
Okay.
All right. So number one, Pamboli or Rolling Stones or the Rolling Stones?
To see live or to eat?
To see live.
It would have to be the Rolling Stones.
Okay.
I've lived with the Pamboli.
I have to ask the hard questions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay?
No.
So if you feel challenged,
I've only seen the Rolling Stones twice. Yeah, and I've seen Pamboli, you know, and I play with one of the guys. Yeah, so they're fabulous.
They're fun as heck.
Yeah.
And Mick Jagger is amazing.
And the guy Keith Richards.
Amazing. I'm going to read his book.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to read his book. I'm going to read all their books. I'm going to read the Pamboli guy's books, too. I'm just going to, yeah. Acoustic or electric?
I have to go acoustic.
Okay.
Yeah, I play electric. Yeah. I love my electric guitar.
Yeah.
It's great fun.
Yeah.
And you take it anywhere. But acoustic, there's more range that one could... Well, that's not true. I play acoustic with Tomas, and I jam in the bar with my electric, so...
But I mean, acoustic. It's a tough choice, but I like that you picked acoustic. That's a cool answer. Interesting answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I bought an acoustic, so it's just...
I know, you did bring your acoustic. We're still going to get there. Esbarang de Binyarach or El Tech?
Where's El Tech?
The Tech? Giant mountain, top of Dea.
Ah.
The Tech.
Okay. I haven't been up to the Tech.
You've never been up the Tech?
No.
In all these years?
No, I've walked from Valdemosa across the... Yes, I have been up. Yeah, it comes up from
Yes, you can do the Valdemosa way or you could do the Esmolí way.
No, I've done the Valdemosa way.
Okay, you've climbed over the saddle. Like you've
It's Tech.
Yeah.
For me?
Yeah.
Because it's easier on the knees.
So you're going to pick the Tech over the Barranc?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I mean, to say that is easier on the knees is amusing because it's pretty much straight up and straight down. But
yeah. Well, yeah. I've done the Barranc. I've never been across to the lakes.
The Barranc kind of like bypasses quite an interesting torrente.
There's like, there's a lot
of water in
but
there.
But I walk up there. I walk up there. Yeah. I suppose because I've only done this once.
Yeah, you're going to say that.
And I live... You know, Fornalutch and Soya. So I'm walking up the bike.
It's more there. You're more there.
Yeah.
This is more of a rarity.
Yeah.
Okay. So you'll say the Tech?
Yeah.
Good answer.
For
you're
the view,
a day.
For the view.
Absolutely.
The view is just, it's astounding. Yeah. The
Tech is amazing. Fresh water or salt water?
Fresh water.
Okay.
It's the most, I'll just add something.
Yes, yes, yes.
Fresh water is the most threatened habitat and resource on the planet of the Earth. It is diminishing year upon year, and it is going to drive the migration of billions of people within the next century. So fresh water.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I know. You have I'm envisioning like a Mad Max movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, people like fighting over like this much water.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's a bummer. Humans, up your game, people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Start figuring this out.
Swimming, I love seawater. Yeah, fresh water.
Fresh water is life, right? Yeah. It's oxygen, water, food.
It's life.
Without it, you're not doing it. No. So, yeah. Teaching or researching?
Researching.
Okay.
Researching. Because I used to, with your research, you can draw other people with yourself, and they can learn alongside you. We can all learn together. Whereas teaching is
giving the information.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got it. Performing at Safonda, or jamming at the house with your buddies. I want an honest answer here.
Okay. Jamming at home with buddies.
Totally, totally fair answer.
Yeah.
Even though I would imagine sometimes that a Safonda performance feels like a jam.
Just remove the egos. Yeah. I shouldn't have said that. But if you remove...
That's okay.
Yeah,
that's
but if okay. you remove the attempts to dominate.
Yeah.
Jamming at Safonda used to be great. At Christian's Bar was wonderful because it was like your mates in your living room.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yes.
And the guitar got passed around, the drums got passed around. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all a bit more formal and but it's busier now. There are
Very busy. Yeah. It's very busy. Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, I guess the whole question of the ego is an interesting one in relationship to Dea, because Dea has morphed into something completely different than it used to be, and
yeah,
it's less casual. You know, like, do you remember when, like, people would show up to everything wearing, like, holes in their pants and, like, a ripped t-shirt? And, like, it was, yeah, it's changed. The vibe has changed. Okay.
Yeah, but both are great. But both jamming are great. At home with mates.
You're like, yeah, I get that. I get it. Hiking or swimming?
Swimming.
Good answer. English climate or Mediterranean climate?
Mediterranean.
Cervezas or yerbas?
That's a tricky one.
Well, your English, it probably is.
red wine.
Ah, good answer. Okay, good. Great throw out. But do you have a preference? Do you like yerbas?
I do like yerbas seco if it's homemade.
Yeah, me too.
If it's homemade.
Cool. I agree.
Yeah, my Trinidad's brother-in-law made the best. Yeah.
If you know somebody who makes good dry yerbas, you're a lucky person. It's super, really excellent. Yeah. Sunrise or sunset?
That's a difficult one.
Yeah.
Sunrise, if I can get there, but it's rarer these days.
Great answer, actually. I kind of agree with you. I think there's something profound about being up that early.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of almost know you're going to catch a sunset.
Yeah.
But a sunrise is a rare occasion.
Yeah. And if one went during COVID, and for 3 years I was living above Fornalooch in the mountains, and the sun rose through my bedroom window.
That's amazing. What a great place to be during COVID.
Yeah, it was wonderful. But the sun would literally...
That's very cool.
...come up. Over the mountain, and I was quite lucky because sunrise wasn't till 9:30.
All right, so here's how I want to wrap this one up.
Okay.
Do you want to play something for us? Do you want to play a thing?
I'll play one little number.
Okay.
Just a little piece of guitar.
Okay.
Okay, and it's not one of mine. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's one of Kevin's.
Oh.
From years ago, and I'm not going to sing it.
Okay.
I'm just going to play a few bars.
Okay.
Because
it's... And if you really get into the groove, just play the whole thing.
It's not... It's a song called Lady Rachel that I think was written in 1969.
Oh, wow.
And I played it once this way, and it's not about his daughter, I was told, by the mother of his daughter, Rachel, called Cyril. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
She said... that he wrote it, the song, after he'd been in Seville in the centre of Spain. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first met him,
mm-hmm.
He taught me, well, he showed me this angle on the song that has never been, I've never seen anybody else do it this way.
Okay.
So I'm just going to do it for fun. Cool.
Excellent.
If the guitar's in tune.
Okay.
And I could get crucified for this.
Well, you know what? I say take a chance.
Take a chance.
Take a chance.
Okay, it's a really...